Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Leonard Zeskind will discuss his 40 years of research into white nationalism. Zeskind traces the movement from the late 70s to the present. Most alarmingly, he will explain why he believes that fringe ideas of hate and nationalism are transitioning into the mainstream. This show was recorded on March 10th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI.
Good morning. Welcome to the UU Forum at All Souls Unitarian Church. If any of you want a head start on asking questions later, there are some seats up front that are going to be closer to that microphone. Invite you to come forward. This morning, I'm Walter Wells, a member of this congregation for a few years, and this morning we have with us Leonard Zeskind, who has been monitoring the right-hand side of our country for, as he just said, about 40 years. And he's the expert that I know closely who has been doing that. He's author of a book, Blood and Politics, which he may show you a copy later of. And I'm going to get out of here. And Leonard, the microphone is yours.
Hello, can you all hear me okay? I'll take these out anyway. I've been an activist working against white supremacist movements for about 40 years. Before that, I worked in heavy industry for about 13 years and was active on the factory floor, and I actually enjoyed that. I was a steel fitter and a welder, and my hands didn't shake so bad in those days, but they had a little tremor to it, so it could make the welding bubble go pretty good. I was part of a collective that founded the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights in 1983, and I have been organizing, speaking, and writing on white supremacy during the years since. And I've written for the New York Times, LA Times, The Nation, The American Prospect, Rolling Stone, and about Searchlight magazine in England, and probably about five dozen other things. I'm also a fully paid-up life member of the NAACP, and I will be one of three speakers at the branch's Black History event on Sunday, March 24th. Write that down. Sunday, March 24th, 3 p.m. at Bruce Watkins Center. So that's going to be a good event, actually. My institute, as some of you might have noticed, has a table in the back, and my book, Blood and Politics, the History of the White Supremacist Movement from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Judy Thomas, a Kansas City Star reporter, Judy Thomas's book, Wrath of Angels, The American Abortion War, is back there. And I recommend both of those, but I think we have more of Judy's book this morning, and I urge you to take a look at it. In February, someone tried to burn down the Planned Parenthood clinic in Columbia, and the clinic did not even perform abortions there. Somebody might start shooting doctors again. And to understand this, and you need to understand the opposition if you're going to defeat those opposed to reproductive rights, you should really read Judy's book. So I hope you can visit our table after my speech. I'm going to speak for about 30 minutes. I'll take questions afterwards. So if you think of a question, write it down and ask me at the end. Please do not try and interrupt me. Thank you. Thanks to Walt Wells for asking me to be here. I didn't ask to be here, but he asked me to be here and speak on this topic. And thanks to this church for hosting us all. And there are some people here that we should notice. Zach Mueller, stand up, Zach, is the digital communications specialist for America's Voice, a national immigration reform organization. And we all want to thank him for the pioneering work he did to help keep an anti-immigrant bigot out of the Kansas governor's house. So thank you, Zach. Michael McCormick Enriquez, stand up, Mike, the executive director of Stand Up KC, the headquarters of the movement of low-wage labor in Kansas City. And they've done and will continue to do a great job, and they're making history. And we call these people fast food service workers. I just want to point out they are at the point of production in the same way I once was. They take raw materials and turn it into a commodity that sells. They create new wealth, and they're paid like peons. They do not work out of revenue, it should be known. And finally, and not least, is Gina Chiala. Stand up, Gina, wherever you are. Thank you, Gina. She's an attorney from the Heartland Center for Jobs and Freedom, and they're doing great stuff. And she is also a member of the board of the Institute for Research and Education on Human Rights, along with me. Now, often when I ask, all right, Zach, let's turn it on. Well, I'm taping this, so, or Zach's taping it. Now, often when I give one of these speeches, people ask me to talk about the latest threats from the white supremacists and the far right. And I do that quite often. And if that were the case, and it's not the case, but if that were the case today, I would talk about how a former National Alliance, you know, these are the guys that the follower of one of them bombed the Oklahoma City building. A national organizer, Billy Roper, wants to establish Ozarkia as a demographically white ethno-state in the northwest corner of Arkansas. I would talk about Identity Europa, which you all should know about, which is quietly organizing white supremacists on area university campuses right now. And I would thank the Kansas City Star reporter Judy Thomas again for her October 2016 article on the beginnings of this problem. And I would perhaps talk about Adam Waffen. There's about 80 of these guys nationally, a small violent group of national socialists. National socialist means neo-Nazi. Think Nazi. Whose members have killed a number of people in California. And I would talk also about the Proud Boys, also founded in 2016. That seems to be a turnaround date, and I'll get to that later in the talk, when all-male white supremacist street gang of street fighters that is particularly dangerous, they're in the area, and they have about 3,000 members internationally. So they've grown quickly and dangerously. Now, I could go on and on like that and in more detail, but I was specifically asked to explain how we got to the place like the one we are in. So we have an uninformed racist bigot for president and a hardcore sector of the population that will support him and his policies at any rate cost, and we are demographically, geographically, and politically polarized with neither side able to talk to each other. So that's what Walt asked me to talk about. And I will say from the beginning that Trump is the result of this condition we are in. He is not the cause, and there's a lot of mistake on that. He follows. He does not lead. And if we're going to explain how we got from there to here, we should begin probably with more about here so that we understand where we're at. And I want to say it's a balanced and polarized situation. So I'm not only going to talk about the bad guys. This is one of those talks where I get to talk about the good guys for 5 seconds. Well, today, legislation to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour is coming out of committee in the House of Representatives and Congress. That's a great step. There's no guarantee that the House or the Senate will actually pass that bill or that Trump will sign it. But we have moved as far as we have on this wage issue, largely because of the work of the people like Mike and the Fight for 15 movement and its supporters. So let me ask you to give them all a hand like you just started to. My one word of caution on this, as I told Mike the other day, all reforms such as this are granted, when they are granted, to undercut the strength of the mass movement that pushed for it. And as you know, a raise in the federally mandated minimum wage is not the recognition of a union. And these people need a union bad. And please let me remind you that union membership, which in my youth was sort of, I never worked a job that I didn't have a union on. Never. The union membership in the private sector today is 6.4%, a pitiful, pitiful number. There's been a rebirth of the Poor People's Campaign. It's a huge undertaking, and it's beautiful. And I spoke at an event in a Washington, D.C. synagogue where the leader, Reverend Barber, was giving the talk that day, and I was one of the prelims. And it might yet win recognition of the needs for poor people, but it has not done that yet. And it is unlikely to win the restructuring of our economy that poor people need. But I would love to see it in my lifetime, but I won't. As of September 2018, there are 50,000 members of the DSA, Democratic Socialists of America. And their average age has dropped in 2 years from 68 to 33. That's a good sign. Now, I would not be too scared of this socialism. It seems to me to be an actual extension of FDR's New Deal more than anything else. So there's no talk about state-run anything. There's a large and significant rebirth of the women's movement. The Me Tooers are powerful, but they have not stopped rape. And the law enforcement response is at best uneven. And the women's movement has grown large enough to develop internal differences that need to be addressed. So some go, some not. LGBTQ stuff has advanced. People are getting married. But there's new insults in the stuff from the Methodist Church recently where they denied their marriages and their pastorates is not good. This is all good stuff with limits, right? Environmentalists and scientists have gotten their word out on climate change. And the rising tides is likely to wash Miami Beach off the map sooner than we can afford to go there for a vacation. But there is a rock-hard segment of the population that does not believe science or consider the whole mess of environmental racism a problem either. You might get a few answers in California, but nothing out here. And the same is true for immigrants. We all know we need immigration reform. And many of us believe, like me, that barring immigrants or trying to bar immigrants is one way to increase misery around us. On this topic, I think of the SS St. Louis in 1939, carrying 900 Jews fleeing Nazi Germany. They were turned away in Cuba and the USA and Canada and some countries in Europe. The immigration law in those days, the law that turned them away, was written to satisfy an upsurge in the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. Nobody would take these immigrant refugees, and many of these Jews subsequently died in Hitler's camps. We all know from brute experience, that labor follows capital. That's why Detroit's emptying out. And you can't sell corn and everything else in Mexico without their corn farmers coming up here and fixing the roofs and washing the floors and working hard for little pay. It just doesn't work. During the presidential election, Trump campaigned continuously against these immigrants, using all sorts of ugly racist slurs to describe them. He called undocumented immigrants rapists, thieves, and gangbangers. He's the rapist. Never did he describe them as hardworking people living in brutal conditions who are just want a chance to work hard and live peaceably. Now, we all know that President Trump wants to build a wall on the southwest border of the immigrants. Remember, he campaigned on that point, and he said he wanted Mexico to pay for that wall. But after enough racist invective, Trump threw at Mexicans, which he did. He can't even get the president of Mexico to talk to him. Please remember that Trump seized the children of undocumented immigrants, housed them separately, and inhumanly separated them from families, many of them permanently. That's a crime. Several lawful bodies have sued the government because of this, and it is widely unpopular, but not completely unpopular, among Americans. But Trump still held on to a significant anti-immigrant bloc in the population, and that's the problem. Trump began arguing for a border wall during the election again. No mention of Mexico paying for it was made. After the November election, with Democrats in control of the House and a majority opposing a wall, as you know, Trump allowed the government to be shut down for 35 days in his attempt to force Congress to pass a bill on this. After the government was fully restored, Trump declared a national emergency to build the wall, a move most commentators believe to be without any constitutional authority. Lawsuits were filed by a dozen states, and the House is taking this up. Remember, it's the House of Representatives under this Constitution that pays the bills, not the president. It came to light during this period, and I didn't know whether to add this, but I think it has to be, that Trump had undocumented immigrants working for him for many years in his hotels and resorts. They were promptly fired by Trump when it got known this winter. One of the workers, who I quote, Victorina Morales, who was working at a Trump golf course in New Jersey, said it all. She said, this is it. There are millions of us here without papers, and the country depends on us. Trump knows that because of his businesses depends on us, and he knows how hard I worked. And so she got canned. That's what this is. Now, this is the nut of the issue here. Now, 41% of Americans told pollsters before the government shut down that they wanted a wall built. Now, it's not a majority, but that's a significant minority. During the shutdown, that number dropped to 31% who told pollsters they still wanted a wall, even if it meant shutting down government. 31% is not a mean, small number. Now, I believe that understanding that 31% is key to understanding what is happening now. Indeed, I believe that understanding the politics surrounding immigration is one of the keys to understanding what is happening now. So let's go back to then and figure out how we got here, because that's what Walt wanted me to do. White supremacists have been campaigning from the margins steadily against immigrants in the post-civil rights period. In 1977, David Duke, then the boss of the Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, campaigned against immigrants in California and initiated the first, quote, border watch by armed racists. In the early 1980s, Aryan Nations, I used to get these flyers everywhere, including among farmers in Kansas, Aryan Nations issued a three-color flyer exaggerating the influx of immigrants with big, bold red arrows. Tom Metzger's White Aryan Resistance took up the anti-immigrant call, and a group of his skinhead followers beat an Ethiopian immigrant to death on the streets of Portland in 1988. In 1992 and 96, columnist Pat Buchanan ran in the Republican presidential primaries on an anti-immigrant platform. Now, I might remind you, in 1986, Ronald Reagan passed some version of immigration reform. Conservative Republicans weren't against immigration reform in those days. Now, I'm not a conservative that's conservative by any stretch of the imagination, and I'm not a Republican. But they passed it. 6 years later, Pat Buchanan's running in the Republican presidential primaries on an anti-immigrant platform of America First. He won 3 million votes in the Republican primaries. And that was the beginning of a mainstream phenomenon. You get it? Started right there. And so it went from the margins with David Duke and the knuckleheads, Aryan Nations, and then over to Pat Buchanan's in the mainstream. In 2001, his book, The Death of the West, How Dying Populations and Immigrant Invasions Imperil Our Country and Our Civilization, which built on the themes of his campaigns, is still being read by white supremacists of every stripe, every stripe. During these same years, anti-immigrant politicians led by Tom Tancredo in the 90s epitomized the overlap between respectable Republicans and white supremacists. The Federation for American Immigration Reform and other anti-immigrant organizations formed in the years prior took center stage. And Mexican border vigilantes, I mean, Minuteman border vigilantes, including white supremacists among them, some from the worst, the Church of the Creator, which is a knucklehead organization, had armed people on the border, led the nativist fever to a boiling point. It's not good. During the first years of the Obama administration, and this is contrary to what a lot of people said, SPL, Southern Poverty Law Center, and some people said, Obama's elected, and let's all, the white nationalists are going crazy. Not true. When Obama was elected, hardcore white nationalists were befuddled at the loss of a large portion of the white vote and unable to develop any new initiatives. David Duke supported somebody that's the guy who did the research into the car problems. But the white supremacist's absence from new initiatives gave room to the Tea Party movement, including allowing it to emerge and develop deep roots in the mainstream white people. Now, liberals and progressives got it so wrong. They said these people were false grassroots. That was no false grassroots. I wasn't going to say that, but the Tea Parties were a nationalist movement working to regain the status they believed white people had lost. You know, get it back. And they decided that brown-skinned immigrants would soon cement white people's status as a minority in a nation of minorities. That part they got right. In 2012, it became, we issued a document, it's Beyond Fair, on our website. Go look at it. We issued a document, Beyond Fair, which showed that the Tea Parties were outstripping the Federation for American Immigration Reform and other anti-immigrant lobbies. That didn't keep all the immigrant rights folks from still talking about FAIR like they were the enemy. It was the Tea Party. While Tea Party shared the white nationalist false sense of white dispossession, it focused on building a base in the Republican Party, not marching in the street. And it succeeded. According to a report that we did, my institute did it in 2015, that we distributed at the NACP National Convention that year, there were, at that point, 556,551 hardcore members of the Tea Party. That's not small change. More than 10 times the number which the white supremacists had. The seven core organizations of the movement had, on Facebook, 7,683,327 sympathizers on Facebook. And polling data showed that 18% of the American public sympathized with the Tea Parties. Now, everybody tended to ignore them. Some of the politicians would run against them. But we ignored them, and they grew. All right, that's enough of that. It was the Tea Party movement that adopted the white supremacist nationalism and the sense of white dispossession and carried it further to the center of the Republican Party politics. Immigration had dropped to a 40-year low by 2017. That's a government statistic. It's gone up since then, but it had been down and didn't stop these guys. And it rendered the Republican concerns just slightly fanciful. When Donald Trump campaigned for president in 2016, he centered on this audience, the anti-immigrant fever created Trump, not the other way around. And it's the Tea Parties that took it from the margins to the mainstream. That's the link to understand. Now I want to go back and look briefly at the 31% again. They believe, falsely I might add, that white people are becoming dispossessed. They look at the changing demographics where white people will become a minority in a nation of minorities. They don't know how to share. They do not believe that they can hang on to their white skin privilege anymore simply through majority politics. In a poll from August 2017 that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, 55%, this is huge, 55% of non-Hispanic whites, more than half, told pollsters that discrimination against their group exists today. So 55% told white people are discriminating. And who was the discriminator? Black and brown people. That's what they said. 61%. Now, African Americans was 92%. So they had a more accurate vision of what's going on. But this 31% and the 55% who think that they're being discriminated, this philosophers used to call this false consciousness. It's a term that's not used much anymore, but I think should be. So they support policies to prevent immigrants and the American-born children of immigrants from becoming citizens, and that is unconstitutional. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution, passed after the Civil War in 1866, promised equality before the law to all. And it said that anyone born in the United States is automatically a full-scale citizen with first-class rights. Now, that you know, we all know that didn't actually happen on the ground, but that's what the Constitution said. But the Constitution's there. So for the last six congressional sessions, the white supremacist congressman from Iowa, can you still hear me? The white supremacist congressman from Iowa, Stephen King, introduced legislation to end birthright citizenship. He had pretended the Constitution wasn't there. And it has been fully considered, the number of Republicans supporting it has gone up and down. So one year it was 50 and 70, and now it was 24. This year, King introduced the bill on January 3rd. Boom, he got there. And he wasn't thrown out of his House seat yet. And, well, his committee seats. 28 Congress representatives were co-sponsors of this miserable bill to end birthright citizenship. And guess who one of them was? Lives north of the river. Sam Graves, the congressman from north of the river. Think about that. He has co-sponsored it every time. Somebody should educate the people in that district about the 14th Amendment and the Constitution. Now, we know that bigoted policy proposals targeting immigrants can and do happen at all levels of government, and I wanted to point this out. For example, just this past week, a Missouri Senate committee conducted a hearing on a Senate joint resolution that would require law enforcement to verify the immigration status of individuals if they found, quote, reasonable suspicion to exist that such persons are in the country illegally. So if they're brown, check them out. Pure and simple, we in this room know that this would allow racial profiling of immigrants to occur. And I know we're all working on other issues, and this isn't to say that we can only work on immigration, but we've got to stop these bigots. If we're going to go someplace, we've got to do something about this 31%. We must follow the fast food workers and stand up on the issue. So that's it. Thank you. I'll take some questions.
If the ushers would come forward and take up a collection, and those of you who have questions, please keep them questions, not expository diatribes, perhaps. But Mike is here. Please come forward. And
I promise not to answer any of your questions.
But he might say something anyway.
All right, no questions. Holy moly, you guys get it? Well, thank you very much. Oh, Mike wants to ask me a question.
Could you put this in a worldwide context? I've heard that things like this are happening in Europe, too, in Poland and Hungary, and that the only countries that are dealing with it in an adult...
In France, yeah.
And
England, just for the giggles, consider what's happening in Britain for just a half a second with Brexit. They voted to get out of the European Union. And their farmers are screwed because the farmers sell half their pork. They sell the high-end pork to the Brits, and they sell the low-end porks to the European Union. The companies are shutting down in Britain one after another because it's not going to be able to sell in Europe. Now, I'm not a fan of globalism, but there's another struggle here going on as well. And the immigration stuff, I said, was there because labor follows capital. Capital is global today. It's as easy from New York to send $1 billion to Micronesia as it is to send it to Ohio or Iowa or here, which they don't send it to here. And it's a global issue. I'm actually... done a lot of work in Europe myself, and the white supremacists here are all the time traveling to England and Norway and Sweden and Germany, and the leadership of the white supremacists here are always traveling. One thing you should remember, in the last election, Marine Le Pen in France and the Front National took a huge percentage of the vote. And it's not impossible that they would win in France. Not impossible. Please God, they don't. But I can remember in 1988, we went to France. And I went to France at the end of April, marched in England at a demonstration and for justice, and then came to Paris. And there was a Front National march on May Day. They march on May Day. So I went to that march. And it was huge. Tens and tens of thousands marching down with, you know, a little Joan of Arc figure in the front and all this stuff to capture French nationalism. And they took a significant, they took 18% in the primaries, but they didn't used to take it in the second round. And they're going to take it in the second round. And hopefully they won't win. But, yes, it's a global problem. It's caused by global capital.
You just described the international situation. Could you say that this white nationalist movement is more or less centered in the U.S. South?
No.
And so you don't think this is, in some respects, refighting the Civil War?
Well, I used to work for the Reverend C.T. Vivian. I love that man. He was Dr. King's director of affiliates in the early 60s. And CT used to refer to Kansas City and Chicago and all that territory as the up south. Black people are moving south these days, folks. They're reversing some of the migration. We have a problem in Missouri and in Kansas and California and New York and in Alabama and Mississippi and Georgia. Actually, it's not as bad a problem in South Carolina and Mississippi. Why? Because the Republican Party has complete power in South Carolina and Mississippi, so they don't need an autonomous white supremacist movement to challenge them. They're all in the party. It's a sad and sorry story. I could go on. I spent a lot of time in the South. I used to go to Klan rallies every week in North Georgia. Ugh. Mike.
Well, it's different not to have these conversations at your dining room table, which is what we've been doing for 20 years almost. I just want to say thank you, Lenny, for helping us in Stand Up KC and the Fight for 15 and a Union movement in Kansas City understand that the fight against corporations and the fight for income inequality is intimately bound up with fighting racism and how multiracial unity is key to building working class power. So thank you for that, just first of all. I could clap for you now doing that. So, but the question is, thinking about multiracial unity, thinking about, on one hand, you said it's the best of times. There's incredible mobilizations from the Women's March, the Fight for 15 and a Union movement, Black Lives Matter. There's an incredible amount of movement activity on one hand. But then on the other hand, you've laid out how the power of white supremacy has gone from the margins to the mainstream. And when we think back in 2016, there was a belief in this room and many rooms I'm in across the country that Trump couldn't win. I think a lot of people were shocked that he did win. And similarly, there seems to be a lot of discussion that he can't win again, that just inevitably he's going to be pushed out. And I think people take a lot of solace in Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris. So what do you think, Lenny, is the response to this idea that he is going to lose inevitably, and what do you think the chief challenge is between now and 2020?
Whether or not Trump wins the election, that 31% is going to stay there and get bigger unless you move to stop it. And that's the truth of the matter. And they carry every form of bigotry with them. They're anti-Semitic. They're misogynist. They hate women. Those Proud Boys are proudly misogynist. They're racist and they're anti-immigrant. And they're all of it. That's what white supremacy is. It's all of it. And if we don't stop it, look, we're very good at counting our own toes. We're very good at looking in the mirror and telling everybody how beautiful we are. But it's past the mirror. It's the other side. Take a look at it. If you don't take a look at it, if you don't work against it, if a committee to fight the stuff in the North doesn't come out of this meeting, then I'm cream cheese. We need to fight this stuff. We cannot sit back and say, oh, well, somebody else will do it for us. That's my sad story. I don't know what Trump's going to do in the election any more than anybody else. I do know, however, that 31% isn't going away so fast, and we got to stop it.
Within the Democratic Party, there seems to be a lot of self-discussion and attempts at definition of where it's going. So could you talk a little bit about what you see as some of the influences that the Democrats have to deal with now?
I don't know diddly-do about the Democrats. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I can't tell you. Sorry. I'm not the guy. Mike may be able to tell you that. Ask Mike.
A long time ago, I read a book called The Turner Diaries, and it inflamed me. I want to hear your comment about how can we deal with this group of people who just believe anything? They use the technique of being totally ignorant to essentially justify their tribe.
Let me explain something to you. They're not just believing in anything. Woodrow Wilson watched The Birth of a Nation, the Klan film, in the White House. And he said it was history written with lightning. Woodrow Wilson, who everybody thinks is a wow-wow guy, and I know is a hardcore racist. White supremacy was the law of the land here. And black soldiers came home from World War II fighting racism in Europe and got hung in Georgia and Alabama. Remember that. That's what this country is. We're just getting past it, if we're getting past it at all. So the Turner Diaries is very believable. It was sold at gun shows and survivalist expos and on every Klan list for a while. And I talk about it a great deal in here. And a couple of months ago, the son of William Pierce, who wrote it, contacted me. And he wanted to make sure I knew that he didn't believe like his father did. And we've got a problem, folks, and we cannot step away from it. We got to fight it. I'm sorry. Look, I've been doing this for 40 years, and I shouldn't have to yell at you to get this going.
I support the Southern Poverty Law Center.
Why do you do that?
How effective is it?
It's very effective, and it has a good legal team, and it's got more than $250 million sitting in the bank. So it doesn't need your $25.
Well, I give more than that, but...
Well, you should give it to the Institute. We'll use it. They're putting it in the bank.
What Institute? Repeat.
My Institute, the one at the back that says www.
Are there other... My question was, are there other centers doing this kind of work, and what is our most effective way of fighting this?
Well, yes, there's a number of organizations. Some are more effective than others. What SPLC does when it does it is right. I don't agree with them on everything. I don't agree that counting numbers of groups tells us anything. I think you got to count the numbers of white supremacists. So I have some difference. I like Morris. I know several of his ex-wives. Sorry. You want to give money? Like I said, there's an address in the back. Yes, sir.
So as far as models of organizing and bringing people together, what have you seen as you travel around the world? Which groups of people are really proficient at working together, and what do those models look like?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I think everywhere we go, the models look different. In Portland, in the late 80s, when the skinheads were on an upsurge, it was young people organizing, and some of them were young, not racist skinheads who were organizing, and they challenged the skinheads in their music sessions. Today, where a lot of the fight is in the electoral arena, I think we should have some political action committees to fight Graves, like we did with Kobach. And I think that somebody's going to have to organize one, and at least one, and get that going. I think that communities standing up and educating themselves on the problem, however, is the first step. Organizing is the second step. If you don't know what you're doing, and you treat the National Socialist Movement to a screaming match downtown instead of organizing moderates, you're making a wrong move. And by the way, the National Socialist Movement just lost their leader, and some people said it was a black guy took it over. That's not true. The guy in Kissimmee, Florida, took it over, their chief of staff. So there's different ways to do this. If you got a specific place you want to talk about, maybe we'll talk. Yeah.
I just wanted to ask a couple of the last questions. People are starting to get to this question of how can we effectively combat these things? And in, as you were talking, there were a few things you alluded to. You talked about like being out in Kansas farms in the 1980s. You talked about working on factory floors for 13 years. And you also kind of alluded to appeals to the Constitution and why anti-immigrants, we should actually be pushing back about how they're anti-constitution in the same way that they've tried to do to us. So I want to hear you talk a little bit about what is the basis upon which we should combat that 31%? What's the basis upon which we should be appealing to people in St. Joe, in Sam Graves' district, to win them over to an anti-racist agenda for all?
Daniel, that's a complicated question. And I'll be glad to discuss it with you and Mike separately around the kitchen table. I want to thank you all. Is there one more question? Okay, ask the question, and then I won't give you any answer.
Many feel, regarding the 31%, many feel that this group has felt put down, made fun of, you know, as the superior elite and
right.
educated, highly educated, and say some of the rural people, maybe we
It's
should...
suburban and rural. It's not just rural people. You go to South Johnson County and the bigots are as thick as...
But they're happy to have somebody like Trump to fight for them.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody finally is fighting for them, so...
Right. Thank you. Thank you all. You've been very kind to me. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming today. We will be having a forum with an issue. Again, next week we'll be talking about the effectiveness of the vote in the area. Encourage you to...
Sam Graves on the issue.
And I have here for Mr. Zeskind.
Another blue mug! I got this the last time. Thank you.
If he keeps coming back, he may have a full set.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, From There to Here with Leonard Zeskind. This program was recorded on Sunday, March 10th, at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.